Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The summer bird season is in full swing. Joining us to share her insights and observations is Julie Zuckerfuss, a regular on the show since it started last September. And because someone told me they make a nice matched set, we invited Julie's spouse, Bill Thompson, editor of Birdwatcher's Digest, along. So they live together with their two children on 80 acres in southeastern Ohio. They play in a band together, the Flying Orangutans, and they often travel together for personal appearances at birding gatherings. You'll find their links to their books and their blogs on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Julie, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's great to be here, Ann. Thank you.
And Bill, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Yeah, I think I need to explain that I did not take Julie's name when we got married.
I didn't take yours either.
Hey, what happened? You're not even in the same room right now.
No, it's better that way.
And, I didn't know if I was making too much of a leap there, but is there such a thing as the summer bird season?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is baby season. This is when all the birds are cranking out their nestlings and feeding their fledglings. And, I'd say it's about as active as birds get right now.
Bill, what do you do? Is it like a hot time in the magazine office right now?
Well, you know, we're bimonthly. We publish six times a year, so we're not really on the same news cycle that maybe you guys are there. So we do have, however, we notice a distinct uptick during the migration season. So summer is actually a slow time for us because people are on vacation and so forth. But, you know, as we build towards spring migration coming out of the winter, we notice a lot more activity with our magazine and the submissions and with, you know, advertisers and also with our activity on our website. And the same thing toward fall migration. Summer's actually a little slower.
You know, you're both going to be at Lakeside in July and Dayton in August. And in Dayton, you're there for the Midwest Native Plant Society's second annual conference. How much does the eradication of the native plants affect what you do as birders, Bill? Because that's something that's like, and it's not birds, it's plants.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think there's been a general trend over the last couple of decades as more and more bird watchers have gotten experience. You know, we're no longer all Miss Jane Hathaway and the gaudy professor. So, and we're starting to look beyond birds now to plants and butterflies and things like that. You tune in on that sort of ecosystem habitat level, it's vastly more interesting if you know what you're looking at. And, of course, native plants and birds have evolved over the eons to live together. When you get an invasive exotic in, or a bunch of them, as we have here in Ohio, it does change the dynamic, and it really hurts native bird populations in certain ways.
Julie, is that wild onion still your demon nemesis?
Wild onion. I'm trying to think. I think my
you mean
that garlic. That garlic. Sorry.
Oh, wild garlic.
Yeah.
Actually, well, so far it hasn't shown its face on our place. The garlic mustard from Eurasia hasn't shown its face on our place this spring, but I've been pulling it all around Washington County. Yeah, and that's my nemesis. But right now, actually, on my top of my to-do list for this morning was to chop away at some wisteria that's trying to overtake a blue spruce tree, if you can imagine. And this is something that's a legacy of the farmhouse that was here, you know, since probably the turn of the 20th century. And they planted the requisite Victorian wisteria, and I'm now looking out at this monster, the size of our house, that has covered an entire hill. And it really, at this point, only a bulldozer could help us.
Wow.
It's hideous.
You haven't found any on 80 acres of that garlic?
Yeah, well, the first place it ever showed up was in my compost pile, and I suspect it came in with some soil from elsewhere. And so I pulled everything I saw, and so far, so good.
Bill, you've written a book to show children how to birdwatch. And I was wondering, how is that different from teaching an adult to birdwatch? Because you've also written the Birdwatching for Dummies book, which I assume is for adults.
Well, yeah. You know, the first comment I got at the first sort of talk I gave about the Young Birders Guide, a woman came up to me. She said, I'm buying this for my grandson, but I flipped through it and I realized you should have called it the New Birders Guide, because this is all stuff that's perfect for me. So as far as the subject matter, it's really no different, no matter what age you are teaching somebody about birds, or I would assume about any other subject. But I think the thing that makes it different on the young person's side is I just really tried to make it fun and interesting to read, because it seems like kids get hooked about that 8, 9, 10-year-old age if they're going to get a spark about birds. It often happens right in there. And those are kids who are readers. You know, they're not just interested in pictures and things like that. They want something that they can laugh about or kind of think is cool or gross. So we've got all that. Heavy on the gross and the young birds guy.
Your daughter Phoebe's elementary school class helped with that?
That's right, yeah.
How did that work?
When I pitched the idea to Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, to my editor, Lisa White there, she said, well, that's a good idea, and I know you do a good job, but how's it going to be different from any of the other young bird guides or nature books out there? And I said, well, I have an idea about that. And I gathered up every single nature-oriented book aimed at kids and took them into Phoebe's fourth-grade class. This was about halfway through the year. I said, well, you guys, go look through these books. I'm coming back next week. You tell me what you like and what you don't like. And it really came right up to the surface right away that they didn't like the books that were over-designed for eyeballs. They wanted to read. So, you know, adults think kids want all this, you know, biff, bam, pow, bright colors, you know, fierce-looking eagles and that kind of stuff. And, boy, the kids really rejected that. They wanted meaty, interesting, like I said, cool, wow, gross stuff. And so that really helped. And we worked. The kids helped me. They vetoed various designs. They helped me pick the photos. They helped me write the wow facts in the book. So we worked all through fifth grade. And then halfway toward the end of sixth grade, I got to walk in there with a box of books and hand them out.
They must have been excited about that.
Yeah, we were all very excited about that. It was a cool moment.
My guest, Julie Zickafoos, natural history writer, artist, NPR commentator, and also Bill Thompson, Birdwatchers Digest editor and author, and they just happened to be married. You've traveled all over the world birdwatching. I suppose, Julie, you have too?
Not quite as much as
yeah,
Bill.
Yeah, yeah. Bill, all over the place. You were just in Guyana?
I was in Guyana in March.
Yeah, you've been writing about it in different parts. What's the most memorable? Where have you been that was the knockdown drag out best?
Well, I think different places are best for different reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've gotten to go to Guatemala a bunch, and the culture that's the sort of Mayan indigenous people's culture that's still in place there is fascinating to me. So there's this whole other world, along with birds and butterflies and things that you're down there enjoying that you can see, and the clothing and the language and the food and the way they live. It's just fascinating. So that's kind of high on my list for cultural side of things. For birdiness, I got to say Guyana is pretty outstanding. You know, Guyana was everywhere you looked, there were birds. But you know, I think sometimes we forget that you don't have to go to these far-flung places to really get yourself in and among neat birds and interesting situations. I mean, we go out to North Dakota every year, and that on the continent of North America, that's got to be in the top couple of places for just sheer volume of individual birds. And you get out there, and every direction you look in, there's something. You can't find an empty field in your binocular.
You know, I had Cy Montgomery on about a month ago or so, and she finally got it through my head, the fabulous Cy Montgomery, I should say, that every bird, the birds are that species, they're everywhere. They're all around. It's this wildness. It's all around us. It's not, you don't have to see a lion or tiger walk through your backyard. I mean, there are birds everywhere. They're all wild. And they're also each one of them individual.
That is the absolute truth, and there's no better way to know that than to raise one. And, you know, see how it's different from others of the same species you've raised. It's pretty incredible.
Now, do you still have the mourning dove?
She, at about 60 days of age, she departed, and that's as it should be. And, of course, I examine every mourning dove that comes into our yard minutely to see if I can recognize it. But, they naturally disperse, and sadly we haven't seen her. She was last seen landing on our house sitter's arm while we were in Yellowstone Park. Bummer.
She just can't stay away. You brought her on a trip with you, though.
No, we didn't.
Oh, you didn't. Okay. Did I misunderstand?
We had to take her to the New River Birding and Nature Festival in Fayetteville, West Virginia in May, right at the end of April, beginning of May, because when you're hand feeding a bird, you have to bring it with you wherever you go.
You know, the bird's name is Lily?
Libby.
Libby.
Libby Lou. Mm-hmm.
Libby Lou. How do you name your
I let the kids
friends?
Name them. And Phoebe wanted to name it Olivia, but I thought that was a little formal, so we made it Libby Lou.
Too many. I've always found with my dogs, if I like to give them one or two syllables,
yeah,
they're easier to call them.
That's right.
I wanted to name her Olivia Newton-John, but it seemed like that one was already taken.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We welcome your questions or comments. For Julie Zickafoos and Bill Thompson, editor of Bird Watchers Digest. And, John, you're on the air with Julie and Bill. Hi, John.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yes, am I on?
You're on.
Okay. First of all, I want to thank both of you for a great, great magazine. The Birdwatcher Digest is one of the few periodicals that I read cover to cover as soon as I get it. And I enjoy it immensely. It's fun, and it's interesting, and it's humorous, and it's sometimes even sad, but it's a great magazine. I love it.
Well, thanks.
Also, Julie, I've got to comment on your recent article about parrots. I, too, am a 25-year mate of an irascible, judgmental cockatoo, and and I have to say that your comments are right on the money. They're wonderful pets unless you have one, and then they're terrible pets. And I have people visit me who say, "Oh, what an adorable, cute bird! Yeah. Well, I wish we could have one." And you just can't get them to understand how much work they are.
Well, you know, my standard rejoinder is, want him?
Yeah, right. Would you like to take him home?
We'll even throw in the carrier.
Glad you mentioned that. You know, there's Snowball the cockatiel, though, that...
Oh, yeah.
That everybody wants Snowball, but the reason why Snowball is with where Snowball is now is because they had to get rid
of him. Absolutely, and it's sad, but very understandable. Birds, large birds, they live forever, and they're difficult, and they demand. They don't just ask for attention; they demand it, and it's hard some days.
It's hard all the time, and
yeah.
That's why we built a separate room for our macaw, because you know you have to be able to shut the door on that yelling sometimes.
Yeah. I was going to observe one thing that I thought was interesting, that the cockatoo evolved on the opposite side of the world from your macaw, and yet their behaviors are essentially identical. And I wonder if that's just common to all birds. And it's one thing that we've observed in our own bird watching, that knowing a bird as well as we do, that we look for certain behaviors in wild birds, and we see them all the time. It's not hard to spot cockatoo behaviors in blue jays. And I wonder if there's something inherent in just the bird society, bird relationships, that creates that kind of behavior.
Well, you know, are you talking about like the mate guarding behavior and things like that?
Well, that and just some of the ways they interact with you as their mate. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, they're equipped with, all birds are equipped with these sort of hyper-tuned senses of vision and incredibly visually acute, and they pick up on tiny clues. And so,
they do.
I mean, we know our cockatoo or macaw knows us as an individual, but hey, guess what? The blue jays and cardinals do too.
Yeah.
And I had the best illustration of that once when I was driving I'm going to say about 4 or 5 miles from our house as the crow flies. I was coming up a country road, and I saw a group of 14 barn swallows sitting on a wire. And I looked up at them, and I said, 14 barn swallows. I've been wondering for years where the barn swallows that come down to eat eggshells on our roof are coming from. I wonder if it's you guys. I slowed down. I looked at them through the car window. They looked me in the eye, and as one, they lifted off and flew a direct line the 4 miles to my garage roof, because they knew that when I got home, I would throw eggshells up on the garage roof. And I thought, you know, this is the kind of thing that you have to live in one place for a very long time, and you have to watch birds closely for a very long time to make that kind of connection. But the birds are making it all the time.
I think that's exactly right. They're very observant. Very curious about things. They seem to pay attention to everything that's going on around them all the time.
Yeah.
In fact, Harvey, our bird, I think, pays attention to things that don't even exist. Like, we joke about monsters jumping between dimensions that only he can see.
Right.
He'll become all of a sudden excited about something, and we have no idea what it is.
But it's something.
Hey, John, yeah. John, we have to take a break.
Okay.
I appreciate
Thanks a
your
lot,
call.
Julie. Appreciate
Thank
the article.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We'll take a break, and then we'll return to Julie Zicafus and Bill Thompson. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Where do you go for rich conversation on the topics that matter most? The radio is more responsive than the water cooler, and we take your calls. I'm Neil Conan. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Join us for provocative talk on the issues you really care about. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is coming up today at 2 here on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's 22 minutes past 10 o'clock here on WOSU. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurovich today. Morning showers and thunderstorms today. Some sunshine expected late this afternoon. Possible high around 85. Tonight, clearing skies overnight with a low around 63. Tomorrow looking very nice and mild. Mostly sunny with a high near 79. And Wednesday looking even better. Sunny with a high near 77. Now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests, Bill Thompson, he's Birdwatchers Digest editor and author, and also Julie Zicafus, natural history writer, artist, NPR commentator, regular on All Sides. Bill, just going back to your travels around the world, how do you decide where you're going to go and when?
Well, being the editor of the magazine, I'm lucky in that I get invited places.
Okay.
And people want me to come there. And in some cases, they're hoping, obviously, that I'll write an article or put something in the magazine or on my blog about it. And I almost always do. But I think increasingly, many of these ecotourism destinations are interested in getting some feedback on how they can better market to birdwatchers. And I like doing that kind of stuff, too. So usually at the end of the trip, there's a little sit down where you kind of give them feedback on what was good and what needs some improvement and some ideas and so forth. And so it kind of, I'd like it's mutually beneficial, but I know I get a lot out of it just by getting to go cool places and see birds and, you know, meet birdwatchers from other parts of the globe.
Yeah. So what do birdwatchers look for, you guys? What's a good trip for a birdwatcher besides lots of birds? As you called it, a run of birding that was dizzying in one of your blogs.
There has to be
right.
Pie.
I'm with you on that. That kind of goes for anything now.
No, Bill, you take this one, man.
Well, I mean, you know, birders, most of us maintain some semblance of a life list, whether it's written down or on our computers or whatever, you know. We have a list of all the birds we've seen at least once, and that's your life list. And it's sort of like collecting stamps or anything like that. You know, you love getting something that you've never seen before. So that's a big drawing point. If there's a bird that you've seen maybe in a book or on a TV show or, you know, seen a picture of and you've always wanted to see it, and then you get to go and see it, that's really awesome. And but, you know, I like a challenge, too. I mean, a few years ago, Julie and a bunch of us were in Guatemala, and we hiked up this volcano to see the horned guan, which is this highly endangered endemic bird there to that part of Central America and lives way up the side of these old-growth forested volcanoes. And it was a hike that nearly killed most of us. It was just so strenuous. And, you know, while we're hiking up this incredible incline, up a little muddy path hacked out of the side of the volcano, you know, remember there's a guy who must have been 65 or 70 who lived in the village down at the bottom. He went up once, brought some wood back down, went back up, brought back up some sort of, and was past us a third time, but we're huffing and puffing halfway. So, you know,
well, then you have to come down. Coming down from those places, to me, that's almost worse.
But at the top of the mountain was this turkey-sized bird with a red finger sticking up out of its forehead. I mean, what could be better?
And we saw it. Big white eye.
Yeah.
So you found it.
We found it.
Actually, one of the security guards found it. There was a local policeman who accompanied us up there, and he's the guy who found it. He radioed down, and we had to run the last sort of 50 yards up the hill to get to it before it went away. And I think the last 12 yards, I remember my friend Alvaro reaching an arm down, and if he hadn't done that, I'd still be there gasping for breath at the root of some giant tree.
But yeah, I remember you saying, Julie, hurry, it's here, run. I was crawling at that point. I ran on all fours.
The bear walk, right? The bear crawl?
Yes.
Now, a lot of times when I'm reading your blogs, people are taking you places. There's somebody there that shows you where to go.
Right.
That's great, because then you're not getting lost and you're not missing the good place for pie and you're not missing the good birding spot. So,
it's like a fishing expedition.
Yeah.
And you know, we like to return the favor, too, when we get a chance. We like to show people around when they come visit. So.
Well, yeah, and I've read about that, too. And you've also written that, you know, your 80 acres is maybe one of your favorite places to birdwatch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have this great big comfortable bird blind with sofas and, like, air conditioning. It's awesome. And we can look out any window and see all kinds of birds. So it's really hard to get us out of here. And, like, I remember when we were embarking on this last two-week trip we took to North Dakota and then to Yellowstone in Wyoming, I said, why do I go anywhere when the sugar snap peas are coming in? Why? Why do I do this? And I was really – I did not want to leave, but I'd do the trip over again in a heartbeat.
Well, I want to know, why do you have to tell us what you're eating on Facebook all the time?
Have to. No,
it kills me. Yeah. It kills me.
Well, that and planting brain worms for bad songs is my other favorite.
Yeah. Tell us about the Oklahoma trip, because it was beautiful writing, Julie, and sad but bittersweet, I guess.
Well, I was asked in April to be a keynote speaker and to do the art for the poster for a tiny little festival called the Lesser Prairie Chicken Festival in Woodward, Oklahoma. And it was just such a charming little place. I mean, you could really call it a frontier town. It really looks like the set of one of those shootout movies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this beautiful ranch. One of the largest, if not the largest, private landowner in Oklahoma is Sue Selman. And she owns this incredible ranch. And on this ranch are these lesser prairie chickens, which are very endangered birds. And they're endangered because of habitat loss, because we keep plowing up and turning the unbroken prairie they need to survive. They're about the size of a chicken, and they stand out on the prairie and go, whoop, 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 and they puff up, and they put these crazy little ears, feather ears up, and they do this little shuffling dance. And so the people out there got the idea to take people to Sue Selman's ranch for a ranch breakfast and seeing the prairie chickens, and they called it a festival. I went out there, and my friend Tim Ryan, who is an incredible photographer and writer and also a blogger, he has a blog called From the Far Away Nearby, and my friend Debbie Caspery, who is an incredible artist, watercolor painter, she works in many media, paints birds, anything natural history related, they both took me around and showed me the best of Oklahoma, and that meant eating fried chicken with your fingers at Eichen's Bar and Restaurant.
That was regular chicken, I should point out, not lesser prairie.
It was not lesser prairie chicken. And shopping for real denim overalls at a farm store and then having fabulous pie and cobbler at another, the Mears store in Mears, Oklahoma. It was just amazing. And, you know, in between we saw all kinds of great birds like the endangered black-capped vireo. And I just came away with this huge appreciation for a state I'd never set foot in. And the best way to do that is to go guided by people who love it and who show you her best side.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. My guests, Julie Zicafus and Bill Thompson. He's editor of Birdwatcher's Digest. And Julie Zicafus, you might know her from as an NPR commentator and many, many other things, including this show. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your comment there. Love to hear from you. You know, what is it about you guys? Because I could drive for years along a backcountry road and not come upon a cooperative bird of any type, let alone a short-haired, eared owl. You just drive around and they're like, oh, there they come. Let's just. Bill, you wrote about that experience in your blog, and it made me wonder if birders are just better observers than the rest of us.
Well, you know, I can't tell you the number of people, Ann, that I've talked to who've become birders maybe later in life and said, I wish I had my birding eyes when I was, 25 and I went to, Costa Rica on a trip,
mm-hmm.
or when I was up in Alaska as a kid, So I think it's just a matter of tuning in, because birds are pretty much everywhere and a lot of times they're making themselves fairly obvious. But increasingly, as we humans figure out other ways to distract ourselves with all kinds of media and devices and everything, you tune out to that natural stuff. It's kind of a bother. So I do think bird watchers, once you tune in, are highly sensitized to anything visual or any sound that they're hearing, and they kind of zero in on it. I mean, I would, if you really want to patrol the borders of this country, and I would say put fan loads of birders going up and down them. They'd pretty much see everything.
They'd wave the illegal aliens by because there was a green jay sitting there.
Right. Their priorities would be so messed up. 604-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. And you guys, Julie, did you write this? That NPR has just released a new compilation CD called Soundtracks Birds.
Yeah.
And you said three of your pieces and one of Bill's. Three of what?
Three of my commentaries.
Oh, all right. Okay.
My pieces of pie, Ann.
Were they bird sounds? I didn't know.
Oh, no. Generally what NPR wants from me is critter stories, and so that's what I give them. And so I try to come up with amazing stories about, birds that do things that we would never expect birds to be capable of doing, feats of intelligence and rational thinking and things like that.
So what stories did you put in?
I think one of them was about helping wrens with an iPod. I had a nest of Carolina wrens in a little bucket under our eave by our front door. It's a bucket that I put up for them to nest in, and they gladly accepted, and they raised many broods there. But when Carolina wrens fledge or leave the nest, sometimes a baby or two is left behind when the others go. And the parents, in the flurry of taking care of maybe four babies popping around in the woods, they may forget to come back for that last one. So this was the case. And this baby sat in the bucket for 2 hours and then jumped out and was hopping around on my lawn, unprotected, mm-hmm. unguarded. And I thought, oh, this is terrible, because the rest had left and gone into the woods. So I grabbed my iPod and played a Carolina wren song, got no response, played a Carolina wren alarm call, and this wren shot out of the woods right past my ear, landed next to its baby, and took it right back into the woods.
Aww.
It was awesome. So little stories like that about, using technology to help a bird, that kind of thing.
I still think about that bird in the carpet store.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Birds just appear to me all the time saying, help me.
See, I'm telling you, what is it about you guys?
Well, we listen. We hear them. And it's about having the ears and eyes on. It's about having your alertness on.
See, Bill, what's your story about on the CD?
Well, it's actually tied in with the Young Birders Guide that you mentioned earlier, Ann.
Mm-hmm.
When that came out, we sent a copy to Melissa Block at NPR, and just as a courtesy, and she was away at the time, and she came back. She said, hey, could you guys send that book? And somebody had snagged it off her desk. We sent another one. The same thing, I think, happened to that. I thought, well, maybe this book is going to do okay.
A little problem over there at NPR, yeah.
Finally sent one to her house, and then she said, I want you to, when you're over here, let's go out on a bird walk, and I want to take my daughter, Chloe. And we did. And we're going to walk around this place called Huntley Meadows in Northern Virginia. It was Memorial Day weekend, maybe, I don't know, 2 years ago, something like that.
Mm-hmm. It was in 2008, yeah.
Yeah, and we ended up being there for 4 hours. The birds were great. Chloe was completely fired up. This is their Melissa's, I think, six-year-old daughter, who, probably seven now, I guess. She was five at the time. Just has always really liked birds. And we just had a great time. And there was a sound recordist along, and Melissa's husband, Stefan, was there taking pictures. And so we just had a really fun time. Well, this fabulous story came out on the air about a month later. I think we were at Hog Island when we heard it air,
mm-hmm.
and it was on All Things Considered. And that's the story that's excerpted, I think, on this sound collection. So it was a big thrill for me and a real honor to be featured on something like that.
I think Bill Thompson should do commentaries on NPR. I'm just saying.
Well, he's got a nice voice.
He does.
And seems like a nice guy, and he's married to you, so Can't
he's
be
not,
all bad.
He's not really that nice a guy, but he has a great voice.
Yeah. How did you guys meet?
Go ahead, Vic.
Did you get your story straight? Or
well, you can break in any time, but Bill basically asked me to paint a cover for the magazine, and he called me up, and I think it was a pinch hit, wasn't it, for somebody who had dropped out, who said they had a painting and didn't get it done in time, so he needed this thing right off the bat, and I didn't want to do it, and he talked me into it, and then he kept calling, like, to check on it and stuff, and we started talking, and then we found out that we were both in bands and musicians, and it was like, uh-oh. So it was very much a long-distance courtship for a while, and then I lived in Connecticut at the time, and he was in Maryland, and so it took a while to sort of make it all happen, but it was pretty awesome when it did.
Is that the story, Bill?
Actually, it was a personal ad that Julie put in Pie Eaters Anonymous, and I felt sorry for her, and I took her in.
Okay. I didn't send any pictures.
See, I knew. don't be silly. We're going to take a break, and then we'll return to Julie Zuccafoos and Bill Thompson on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
My family and I moved here 3 years ago to take jobs at OSU working for the Department of Dance. The great thing about the local programming here at WOSU is it's taught us a lot about Columbus, but the national NPR programming, it gives us a sense of home in a new place. My name is Michael Wall, and WOSU is my source for a broader community.
You are listening to WOSU 820 NPR News and All Sides with Ann Fisher today. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich. It's just about 20 minutes till 11 here on WOSU. Morning showers and thunderstorms stretching into the early afternoon today. Some sunshine is possible later this afternoon. High around 85. Currently it's 76 degrees here in Columbus. Clearing skies overnight with a low around 62, and tomorrow looking very nice, mostly sunny with a high near 79. Wednesday should be even nicer, sunny with a high near 77.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
Don't forget to tune in this evening for a recap of the Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan's Senate confirmation hearings. That begins at 7 o'clock tonight on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, Bill Thompson, editor of Birdwatchers Digest and also author of several books. And Julie Zuccafoos, natural history writer, artist, author, NPR commentator. Julie, you're working on a new book still.
Don't you hate how
I bring that up every time?
I know, you have to. You know, next year you'll bring it up, and next year you'll, my new book. But I am determined. I have the bit in my teeth, and I am painting. I'm working on a landscape with mourning doves flying over it right now. Not as we speak, but as soon as we get off the phone.
Let me ask you about the mourning doves thing, because when you wrote about Libby Lou, it was a fellow that called you up on the phone and said they'd found a baby mourning dove, and you were surprised because you said 99% of the people who call up and say they found a bird don't know what it is.
They have no idea what it is, and they also kind of like wonder why it's so important for me to know what it is. And so the first thing I do is explain. I say, I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions now, and it may seem silly, but I need to know what color its beak is. I need to know what color the inside of its mouth is, so go get the bird. Pry its bill open and tell me what color the inside of its mouth is. See, all of this bears on what you feed it.
Oh, so you can tell them immediately if they need food immediately, you can help them.
Well, they'll always need food immediately, but they may not need the same kind of food for different kinds of birds. So, yeah, so you want to know what it is first. And the other reason I want to know what it is I want to know if it's worth my going out to, quite frankly, you know, waste my time raising it. Because if it's a house sparrow or a starling, I'm not going to do that. And most of the calls, thankfully, are about starlings and house sparrows that have fallen out of a soffit somewhere, you know, along with a bunch of grass and trash And, you know, I can't spend my time raising exotic birds, so that weeds out a lot of them. So I do an awful lot of phone consultation with people who have found a baby bird and want to know what to do.
So what should people look for when they're trying to identify a bird? What's the best, it takes years to learn how to look at a bird and aggregate, you know, and mm-hmm. disseminate everything you're seeing. But for the beginner, what's the best? What should we be looking for first?
Well, are you talking about identifying wild birds on the wing, or are you talking about a baby bird in the hand?
Well, that's a good point. What about on the wing first?
Well, Bill, I'm going to punt this one to my husband.
Okay. And then we'll talk baby birds in hand.
Okay.
Punt to me for what?
For how? Asked how to identify birds, Bill, and I just thought, you know, that's a question I'd rather not answer.
You're really on a roll there, Chick. What I always tell brand new bird watchers is you start at the top of the head and work your way down and back, sort of the same way you identify humans. You know, you look at the head and face first, and then, you know, you kind of look, get an overall impression after that. And that seems to work. You know, if you flip to a field guide, you realize that nearly all the birds that we're going to see can be identified by field marks that are on the upper half of their body. There are a few that you need the back half, but so that's, you start at the top and work your way down and back. It seems to work pretty well. Once you see two or three things that are notable, then you should be enough clues to match something in the field guide.
Well, the color, the markings, the beak.
Beak is really important. Yeah. Yeah, shape of the beak.
Yeah, shape of the beak, shape of the head. You know, if there's a crest, or if the head is sort of long and sleek, or big and round like an owl. I mean, mm-hmm. really. And then a lot of birds have a ton of field marks on their sort of shoulders and the nape of their neck and the upper back and the upper sort of the breast part. So, and for warblers, you know, a lot of birders kind of have this pathological fear of warblers, fall warblers in particular. Some of them change into drabber colors in the fall. And using that sort of technique, you know, it pretty much dices them all out into knowable characters.
614-292-8513. Email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to join the conversation with Julie Zuckerfuss and Bill Thompson. Julie, what about baby in hand?
Baby in hand, that bill shape, bill length, general size, and inside color of the mouth is, surprisingly enough, really, really good. And whether it has feathers or down, what color, if any, you know, if it has any feathers emerging, what color they are. And it's remarkable how you can walk a person through this. And the first thing I say is, does it fit in the palm of your hand? So that gets us, that's the bigger than a bread box question, that gets us at least in the right realm, you know. But it can still be spectacularly difficult to get somebody to tell you what they have sitting right in front of them. And I remember one guy who said, "I think I got a pheasant." And I said, "Oh, okay, pheasant. Where'd you find it?" "I found it in the middle of the road last night. I think it's hurt. I think it's got a broken wing." "Okay. What makes you think it's a pheasant?" "Well, it's got this real long tail." "Okay. What color is it?" "I don't know." "Well, can you make a stab at it?" "Well, it's kind of brownish. It's all kind of all mixed up." I said, "Would you call it mottled?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay, let's move on to the head. What's the bill like?" "Doesn't have a bill." "Oh, okay, doesn't have a bill. Is it hurt?" "No, just doesn't." I said, "Look real closely. Can you see a tiny, weensy little bill there?" "Yeah, yeah." I said, "Does it have a big eye?" "It has a huge, great big brown eye." I said, "You have a whippoorwill." So it was it turned out to be a nightjar the whippoorwill is a Capermulgid, a goat sucker. It's it's like the nighthawks that fly around and they catch flying insects, and they have basically almost no visible bill, just a great big gaping mouth and this huge eye. And it was just so amazing to go from pheasant to whippoorwill in just a few questions. But really, it's all about bill, face, head, that kind of thing.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote about prairie dogs in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
That they're on the brink of extinction. I didn't know that. I feel stupid.
Well, prairie dogs are a carefully managed species, and that's to say that most states consider them nuisance varmints, and they manage the populations to keep them teetering on the brink of endangerment.
Okay.
So that they don't have to declare them endangered, because once something becomes declared endangered, then you have to preserve habitat for it. So they keep their numbers just above that. So because prairie dogs, in the view of ranchers, ruin land by making holes in it and sort of laying it to waste, in their view. And in the view of an ecologist and birder, to see the community created by a prairie dog town is an incredible thing. The snakes and turtles and other rodents and birds of prey and coyotes and foxes that live off the prairie dogs. It's just insane how much lives around a prairie dog town.
And you think they're cute, too.
Oh, they're adorable. They're
I mean, I always thought they were cute from a distance, but you actually had them.
Yeah, yeah. I found out in Oklahoma that if you sit down to take photos at the edge of a prairie dog town, and these animals are acclimated to people, very important point, in a national park situation where they're acclimated, and people mean Cheetos, if you sit down, they will climb up onto your lap. But I have to emphasize that wild, free-living prairie dogs out on the range, if they see you get out of your car, they're down their holes and they aren't coming back out because they are so persecuted. They're shot by so many people.
Let's take a call now. Joe, you're on the air with Julie Zuckerfuss and Bill Thompson.
Hi. I live close by to Greenlawn Cemetery, and I go over there almost every day, and I've got to started feeding blue jays peanuts in the shell. And quite often I'll throw those out, and they'll even scold me sometimes if I don't get out there in a hurry. But they'll sort through five or six or seven before they select one. And I'm wondering why they're doing that.
Okay. You go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, well, it's a thing. It's a behavior that a lot of the seed-eating birds will do. Chickadees have been documented doing this with sunflower seeds. They're picking up the peanuts, in your case, and they're feeling which one is the heftiest.
That's
got a bigger peanut inside, and these birds know that. Blue jays are smart, doggone birds, and they know that, and they want to get the best, you know, sort of like when you go through the buffet line and you pick out the biggest piece of pie.
Well, also, I've got the red-bellied woodpeckers that come there now, and they're not selective. They just grab it and go. And also, while I'm speaking with you, Greenlawn is such a wonderful place. It has 350 acres of old growth trees. It has a resident great horned owl. And for years I took photographs of the foxes there. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad to say that there's a young den of foxes there again now.
Oh, hooray. Oh,
and I've seen the youngsters. They're about half grown, but I cannot locate their den because I was hoping maybe to get somewhere to a vantage point and take more pictures. But it's amazing how really great Greenlawn is, because people don't realize that with that many huge trees, and I mean there's trees there.
It's gorgeous.
That were big back in 1848 when they opened up, or when they opened the place. So consequently, you're putting out more oxygen right there in that area than probably anywhere in downtown Columbus.
Mm-hmm. Are they
red? You're probably right.
And also, the history there is so involved with five Medal of Honor winners.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's right next to the old Cooper Stadium. Have you, Julie and Bill, have you been there before to
Greenlawn?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's one of the best birding places in Columbus, and it's well known by bird watchers. In winter, it's a great place to go and see things like crossbills and red poles, for the very reason that Joe mentions, that the old growth conifers there bring in a lot of seed-eating birds in the winter, and the cover brings in a lot of birds too. There's a feeding station that's maintained in the middle of the cemetery, and then in the spring, again, because it's this big, beautiful patch of habitat. In the spring, it's a fabulous place to catch migration because you get basically every warbler that passes through Ohio stops at Greenlawn.
And wasn't
there
a merlin
was a man
there
from
this
the
winter?
Cleveland Museum that stopped there a few times, and I've talked with him and met him, and he was doing a survey on the algae that was accumulating on the old monuments.
Oh, neat.
And he said that over a period of years, he's made the study, and I gave him a lot of photographs showing maybe five or six different years of the same photograph of a statue, and he said it's amazing that they are wearing away, and they're aging to a point with this accumulation, I suppose, of the what wears down your stone and so on. And I thought that was quite interesting also.
Joe, thanks for your call.
Okay.
We appreciate
it. You're kind of hard to get into because by the time I find out the number, it's too late. So okay. I've written it down now.
There you go.
But you need to give that number out more often.
I'm sorry. And you know what? My producer, Emma, just told me the same thing. I blather. I know. And I'm trying to get better. But, Joe, thanks for trying again. 614, all right, 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org to talk to Julie Zuckerfuss or Bill Thompson. And Barb, you're on the air.
Hi. We had some house wrens nesting in, well, a nesting box in the yard, and the parents seemed to have disappeared. The babies came out of the house and were hopping around the yard, but they couldn't fly very well, and the parents didn't seem to be tending to them. And now they seem to be gone. I don't know if there was something I could have fed them or what I could have done possibly to help them, or you have any suggestions?
How odd.
Well, the other thing I should mention, too, we have another nesting box in the yard, and there were other wrens just starting to build a nest in there about the same time.
So. It's very odd for both parents to vanish at the same time.
Well, there was a couple days before the babies came out, there were two parents, and then the next day I just saw the one, and then after that, they didn't seem to be coming at all.
Wow.
And I was watching the babies, you know, hopping around the yard calling for their parents, but the parents never seemed to come.
Gee whiz, that's not good.
No, I was very upset. They were adorable.
yeah, that's tough. You know, that's the kind of situation where when you're dead sure that the parents are not tending them and the babies are facing death, you kind of gather them up in a cardboard box and call the Ohio Wildlife Center, right there on Sawmill Road in Columbus. I've run into that. Was anyone spraying in the vicinity?
Well, they do come and spray mosquitoes at night.
Uh-huh.
They started that up a couple weeks ago.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if they did it that week. I didn't hear the fog are coming around that night or the night before or whatever, but the previous week they had.
I am suspicious in situations like this. The pesticide question is always the first one I ask when people say that a nest of eggs or young is abandoned and the babies subsequently die. The first thing that comes to my mind is pesticide spraying that would have killed the adults.
Uh-huh.
By poisoning the insects they eat.
Sure.
And and then the babies in the box are protected from that, and you know, so they live, but the parents die. And really, I tell people that birds don't spontaneously abandon their young for any reason.
No, we've had the box out before, and there's never been anything like this.
Yeah, my guess would be that there must have been a pesticide event.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to hear that, but next time, try the Ohio Wildlife Center, owc.org.
Okay.
We'll post that on the web, too, owc.org. You can go to wosu.org/allsideswithannfisher. Get that, too. Barb, thanks for your call.
Thanks. Bye.
Yep. Well, if you haven't etched the phone number into your arm yet, it's 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have about 2-3 minutes to go with Julie Zuckerfuss and Bill Thompson. How do you two decide to travel together and appear together at different functions?
Well, you know, it's just often comes down to the logistics and the cost. Like our friends out at the North Dakota Festival pay us just enough money that we can fly ourselves out there and our kids, and it just works out well. We love going out there. The kids love the adventures we take, you know, after that. And it's a big draw for us. If we can go together, that's great. But if we can take the kids, that's even better because I think that's what we'll be doing up at Lakeside in July is we'll be up there with the kids for, I think, 4 or 5 days.
Oh, that'll be fantastic.
Well, we're very much looking forward to it. It's such a safe little community, and the kids can ride their bikes all over the place, and that really sweetens the deal for us. But and Bill's right, the logistics do get in our way occasionally because somebody has to hold down the fort if the kids are in school.
Well, I wondered, you've got all these critters all over the place. Who takes care of them?
Not long after we moved here, I got an email from someone who said, I can see your house from my house, and I see your birding tower, and I'm excited because I've always read your writing. And it turned out to be this wonderful family who live just a ridge over, and they are my house sitters.
Wow.
And they take care of, you know, everything that's here.
Yeah, I know.
You should see the list I leave.
Oh, I can't even imagine. How lucky, though. How wonderful. You know, to have someone there. We have an email from Paul.
Yes.
I've heard that filling bird feeders in summer can make birds overly dependent on them. We put out bird seed and feeders in the winter, but after spring comes and natural food is available, we don't fill the feeders. Is this practice a good one? We just have about a minute, Julie.
Go, Bill.
Oh, that's a little bit of a myth. I mean, summer bird feeding allows you to see the young birds coming to the feeder being fed by their parents. Birds have evolved over the eons to take advantage of widely dispersed food sources, and they don't become dependent on our feeders. There are too many other things for them. People wonder, why don't I have any hummingbirds? It's because the hummingbirds, you know, are out taking advantage of honeysuckle and other things blooming. So birds are wild. We bring them in for our entertainment. The reason we slow down feeding in the summer is because we have so many raccoons and things that come to our feeder in the summer. So we just slow it down a little bit, enjoy the birds sort of in the gardens a little bit more. But it's a myth that the birds will become dependent on your feeders.
Yeah. Yeah. We feed in summer for our own enjoyment to see the fledglings coming in. And I had a rose-breasted grosbeak at the feeder yesterday, which thrilled me to pieces. So I don't think you're doing a lot of harm as long as you keep things clean and only put out enough food for one day.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
That is all we have time for. Didn't it just fly by?
Oh, boy. Yep. You're doing great.
Julie Zicofus, natural history writer, artist, author, NPR commentator, and Bill Thompson, editor of Birdwatchers Digest and author as well. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining the show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us here.
Thanks. Take care. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.